beginning to look a lot like Big Mouth. Hello, and welcome back to the Pop Culture Talk Show for the Contemporary Connoisseur. My name's Andrew Harrison, and with me to talk about music, telly, film, and all points in between, we have two quality guests. Ted Kessler, mighty deputy editor of Q Magazine. For over a decade, he's been on the front line of wrangling interviews with the biggest music stars, and he's also the author of the much-admired book My Old Man, which came out this year, and we talked about it on one of our past podcasts. My Old Man contains reminiscences about their dads from everyone from Paul Weller and Chris Martin to loads of underemployed music journalists. Ted is a hardened QPR fan, and as I discovered when I was editing Q, he is the best right-hand man you could possibly wish for. Hello, Ted. How are you today?
Oh, that's so sweet, Andrew, and it's good that you also promoted me, because on the masthead, I'm the features editor, but I feel like I'm the deputy editor, so I'll take it.
You are the deputy editor. I can say it now.
I feel like I'm actually the editor, Andrew, but
to me, Ted, you're the chief executive of the company.
Thank you.
So you have the warm glow of a man who's just gone to press. Have you just, like, put the January one away?
Well, we put the end of year issue. I'm not really sure which month is which anymore.
Yeah.
Because we've added an issue, so we've got 13 issues this year. So it's the last of the year, and it comes out December the 18th, and it's very good.
What's it called, the 13th issue?
A bonus?
Bonus, like December 2.
Does it feel like a bonus?
It feels like a very long year.
Is it like a leap issue?
I don't know what we're going to call it, a money spinner.
Well, it's weird this time of year, isn't it? Because you're always, you know, everybody else is thinking Christmas. And if you work for music magazines, you're thinking January, what the hell are we going to put in there? Yeah. Hot tips for January 2017 is always death, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely not that. But we are really panicking about the next issue, so because we haven't even started it and we have to go to press with it in 3 weeks.
Well, if you're in a pop group and you're listening to the podcast,
now's the time.
Give Ted a call. He's got acres of empty pages to fill up. Also with us is James Medd, journalist. He writes for The Guardian, The Times, The New Statesman, and also TheQuestion.com. He is also a member of that proud band of ex-Word magazine journos. Hello, James. How are you today?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you.
Jolly good. What have you had in your plate in the run-up to Christmas?
In the month up to Christmas? Well, for a freelance journalist, it is inevitably the busiest time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Glorious. But also, my wife has a significant birthday.
Oh, right.
So that's making me even more tense than Christmas.
Oh, God.
So it's great. Yeah,
so essentially,
it's just generally great.
You're going to have to get loads of cushions out there to pay for the significant birthday present for the significant birthday. Blimey. Completing the team, as usual, producing an audio silk purse from the sow's ear that is my voice. It's our producer, the Rick Rubin of radio, Matt Hall. Hello, how are you today, Matt?
Fat bearded and doing yoga on a couch.
I tell you what, though, I don't think Rick Rubin wears a lovely kind of neck scarf like you're wearing right now.
No, he wears kind of... What are those beads that yogic bouncers wear?
Yogic beads?
Maybe.
Yoga beads?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he certainly doesn't wear a Kevin Rowland's 2RIA ensemble that you've got on today. And very beautiful it is.
Going
as
for
well.
The 19th century bargee look.
Absolutely. So we had a bit of technical difficulties last week, didn't we, when the Soho blackout sabotaged the show?
It was really disappointing. I saw tweets from people, like, tweeting pictures of Old Compton Street, and it was pitch black, really pitch black. And I was hoping that there was going to be some kind of... London-centric rerun of the New York 1977 blackout, kind of like, you know,
fornication in the streets,
rising kind of birth rate, and everybody nicking stuff
bins
from all the shops.
Bins going through the windows. Hip hop being invented on Old Compton Street again, all over again.
That would be brilliant.
Yes,
but I don't think they're going to make a 12-part series on Netflix out of it somehow.
No. So if you were listening on Soho Radio last week and you got the Soho Society show, you can hear the full thing. You can hear the full Big Mouth again on our Audio Boom channel, which is audioboom.com/channels/Big Mouth. Who do we reckon was to blame for the sabotage of Soho Radio last week? I think it was Front Row, wasn't it, probably? But with the BBC with garden shears.
Yeah, or maybe, yeah. What's that Radio 2 art? The one with Claudia Winkleman and Jonathan Ross.
Yeah.
They must feel us breathing down their neck.
Winkleman and Ross, yes. Blowing up the power station. Okay, let's get started. It's not exactly pop culture, or maybe it is, but the death occurred earlier this week of Fidel Castro, president dictator of Cuba from 1959 to 2008. Amid all the discussion of Castro's deeply mixed legacy, we wanted to focus on the really important thing, which is, what did he mean for British music journalists looking for an exotic freebie in beautiful Caribbean islands? The Manic Street Preachers, of course, played Cuba in 2001, and they were, of course, the first Western rock band there, not the Stones, as history has subsequently been rewritten. And our guest, Ted Kessler, was there for the NME. Is that right, Ted?
Yeah, I forgot we were going to talk about this. Yeah,
well, we'll give you a minute to jog your memory.
No, it's fine. I'll carry the story out.
While Ted gathers his thoughts, he suggested that we tee up this tune first. For some reason, here is Regular John by Queens of the Stone Age. Regular John by Queens of the Stone Age, from the self-titled eponymous album of the same name from 1998. Ted, firstly, why that tune? What does that bring? What are some of the memories of Fidel Castro for you?
Okay, well, picture the scene. The Mannix are going to play a show in Havana. Mm-hmm. It's the first... Well, they said they were the first band to play there. There probably were other bands before them, but that's how it was billed at the time.
The first, like, non-Cuban band. Well,
it's first Western band.
Yeah.
And Fidel, surprisingly... arrived there.
Yes.
That song comes at the end of the story, but I'll tell you why we played that song. Is that Robin Turner, who's a journalist and was a PR at the time, yes, for the Mannix and a very good friend of the Mannix, mm-hmm, was DJing at that as before they came on. And as Fidel Castro walked into the auditorium and everyone turned up to applaud him, he slipped on a Regular John by Queens of the Stone Age, and there was something so perfect about it because it fit the mood, and there was a sort of the sinister rock vibes of Fidel walking into the room. It was
imagine Eagles of Death Metal being pretty much to the right of Donald Trump, politically speaking. I bet Jesse would have loved that, wouldn't he, to discover this?
Yeah. But anyway, the reason why I met Fidel, when I say met, stood 3 yards from him,
I was
backstage and I was standing with rock photographer Tom Sheehan, which, mm-hmm, we were doing with the NME. And we were worried, we were quite worried about what we were going to put in the piece because it was just the new Mannix album. We were in Havana and you expected to deliver quite a big piece.
Yeah.
But really, it was just a new album. It was just another album piece. And it was like, well, and, you know, shots of the Mannix wandering around the streets of Havana was very nice, but it wasn't much of a story because every other journalist was there. But we were the ones backstage when suddenly the army turned up, closed the backstage down, shooed everyone out, apart from us for some reason. We were standing next to Rob Stringer, who ran Sony Records at the time. And suddenly, he grabbed us. We ran down a corridor just as the door was closing. And as the door closed behind us, Fidel Castro walked in from the other door and walked right next to us. And it was and met the Mannix and had the conversation where he said, what's the concert going to be like? And James or Nicky said, well, it's going to be quite loud. I hope you're okay with that. And he went, well, it can't be louder than war, surely. Which is a good line, off the cuff.
Rock.
And it wasn't scripted. It just came off the cuff and it was very amusing. And it silenced Nicky Wire probably for the first time in his life. And it was a big moment and it was curious. And all the Brits, in the photos, all the Brits have got massive grins on their faces and all the Cubans are deadly serious. And you can tell those who are employed by the Cuban government and who are just freeloaders from the UK.
Yeah, the ones who didn't feed the shepherd's crock and being carted out the room for disrespect.
I had a mate who went to Cuba on holiday on his own, just went and kind of visited the country and ended up getting very drunk with a taxi driver who tried to sell him various illegal substances and get him to do various illegal things. But he was coming back to his hotel in the middle of Havana, not sure where he was, and burst in for a pee and decided to climb over the railings into a park and wandered kind of like 10 yards into the kind of foliage, found some, this is weird, what's this doing here, started to have a pee. When all of a sudden lots of lights came on and lots of Cuban soldiers were pointing at him and he was pissing up against the tank that Fidel had ridden into Havana in the air during the revolution. Thankfully, being drunk and Scottish, they kind of let him off with a bemused grin and kind of pointed him to the way back to his hotel.
That's Ozzy Osbourne on the Alamo, except the communist version.
Pretty close.
Well, it's funny because a few years earlier, in 94, I went with Sean Ryder and Bez to Havana because they decided to do their
could possibly go wrong.
That's how it started because we were meant to fly with Bez from Stansted and just to make sure he got the flight, they booked him into the hotel in Stansted, but he managed to sleep through his alarm and missed the flight.
Brilliant.
Anyway, so yeah, they decided to do their press, American press in Havana because they weren't allowed into America.
So doing it in Cuba, that'll really put them in the good offices of the American government.
As possible. Yeah, but Bez's behaviour was very reminiscent of your friend. Yeah.
So the Mannix, were they in a total fan daze with Fidel then, being staunch socialists and stuff?
No, I think they were conflicted throughout the whole time about being there. Why are we here again? I think that was they knew it was they did quite a lot of cultural visits as well, and they had to go spend a day meeting people out in Cuba generally.
Yeah,
and I think it felt a bit like, oh, what are we doing? Are we being used here, or are we using them?
We're like, duh.
Yeah, exactly. But they still did it.
But the thing is, at least the Mannix, out of practically any group you could still mention, at least the Mannix are going to be questioning that and having a kind of a discussion about it within themselves, which you think is probably quite an interesting and useful thing to do.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that whole thing was put together by the British Council as well, wasn't it? Which I found odd, the idea that we're going to be sort of taking a band that, taking a British rock band that, has got its own staunch criticisms of what Britain does and putting them in the middle of this totalitarian country. Is that the job of the British Council?
It does it all over the place. I mean, I've been on British Council trips to kind of like to the Balkans and to kind of various places in Africa that, it's not about only kind of talking to people that we agree with.
Yeah.
It's about breaking down barriers to and talking to kind of to regular Joes and artists in the community that you're visiting stuff.
Before we move on from Fidel Castro, James, you are the king of obituaries. Did you ever see Fidel's folder?
No, sadly not. It was extensive, I'm sure.
Hey, well, I'm sure they must have been an ever-expanding folder. I just thought you might.
Yeah,
have
yeah. No, I have. I have no. I've never been able to rifle through the folders. But yeah, they're updated regularly. I mean, something like that.
When they were handing out the gigs for writing the obits and writing all the different sidebars and stuff, the guys who got the "it's your job to detail the 376 assassination attempts" were just must have been loving it.
Yeah.
My favourite was the one where they realised that Fidel was a really enthusiastic scuba diver, so they decided to paint some shellfish really bright colours and hide them in the area that he was known to scuba dive, packed with explosives, in the hope that he would swim down and think, "oh, that's an interesting looking shellfish," pick it up, and then die.
Yes, just, we clam.
You kind of think somebody in Langley was sat there being paid to come up with this nonsense.
Was the story about parachuting prostitute assassins into Cuba, was that made up one?
Yeah, I think that was a Russ Meyer movie.
Because half
it?
Of these things sound like they're in a Was Not Was song.
Dolphins are tree, though, aren't they?
What, killer dolphins?
Yeah.
The killer dolphins of the CIA.
And mines on the back of the dolphins and all that is true.
The exploding cigar was definitely real, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
I got one of them in a lucky bag once for Christmas.
Actually, in a certain light, you do bear a kind of resemblance to a ill commander.
What a thinner, poorer, shorter, even more decrepit Fidel Castro. Well, okay, let's actually do some music, shall we? Every week we ask our guests to bring in their current earworm, the tune that is obsessing them at the minute. James Med, what are you choosing and why are you choosing it?
I've chosen a song by Julia Jacklin, who is an Australian singer-songwriter who I've just discovered. I think the album's been out a month or so. I just love her voice, and sometimes I overlook how much a voice affects me, and this one's just glorious, I think.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is Julia Jacklin and Sweet Step.
I was dancing
Julia Jacklin and Sweet Step, as chosen by James Med. So let's have a look at film and telly for a minute, shall we? In an attempt to branch out from our usual concentration on aliens and robots, we have two rather different propositions today. In the cinema, the Second World War espionage romance Allied stars Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, am I saying that right? Cotillard, as a pair of intelligence agents who pose as husband and wife in order to carry out an operation in Morocco. Love blossoms amid the blood and guts, and soon they are the real thing, which is when the complications set in. And on TV, the Swedish crime drama Modus is the latest Saturday night Nordic noir import that's keeping BBC4 viewers out of the pubs and at the all-night ketamine raves. The autistic child of a police profiler witnesses a murder, and amidst the usual twilight landscapes, heavy knitwear, minimally designed restaurants and people saying tack, we have to find out why. Not who done it, but why done it. So let's start with that. Let's start with Modus before we talk about Allied. Ted, you're quite the fan of this frozen, moody murder epic, aren't you?
Well, I've seen two episodes.
Yeah, I think there's only been two so far.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's eight episodes in total.
What are you enjoying about it?
Well, I like the cross between The Bridge and Let the Right One In, the vampire movie. It's got the two vibes for me. It's got the snowy, otherly, slightly spooky autistic child, but also that which and the autistic in the bridge, there's a sort of autistic vibe as well. So it's kind of but there's also a supernatural feel to this, and it's a why done it rather than a who done it. And I quite like the idea of a why done it because you can't really crack it, you have to just watch it unfold.
Yeah, I mean, now that Nordic noir is something that people like deliberately set out to look for, it's a genre in itself. I mean, to me, I'm looking at this and thinking The Killing was so massively, complicatedly plotted and really enveloping and quite long as well, all three of them. Apart from the fact that it's an autistic kid, what is it that sets it apart? I mean, to me, this struck me as a little bit actually slightly samey.
Well, it is quite slightly samey, and maybe that's why I like it, because it's comfort food. It's comfort, you know, tuck. It's a way of learning Swedish. I mean, I do
a very limited.
Procedural crime drama Swedish, but you know, useful.
It is a weird state of affairs, though, isn't it? Where your comfort viewing, your lovely warm blanket, is to go to the frozen north where everybody is emotionally distant and people are murdering. It's worse than living in midsummer going to Scandinavia. You're definitely going to get murdered.
Well, it's become BBC Four's Christmas run up. You know, it's like Strictly, or it's like The X Factor, or I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. It's like every Christmas now.
Yeah.
They put on a mass murdering kind of...
Do you think it's just because they get a lot of snow for not a lot of money?
I really like it. I think the first two episodes are really good. But this one is actually set around Christmas, so it's kind of win-win. There's kind of, you know... win-win murderer bishop, you know, it's great.
It's done better than anything else back home, isn't it?
Oh, really? Is it a really big
kind of
hit?
I think it's been a huge hit for them, and I kind of agree. I think it's a little bit seen this. I mean, I'm a proper nerd about the Scandinavians, so the most exciting thing for me was that Wallander, the original Wallander, pops up. But yeah, the autism and the Volvos in the snow and the brutal murder.
There's an issue in that it's Swedish rather than Danish, so you don't get that pleasure that you've got from all the watching kind of the guy who's the mass murderer, wasn't he the taxi driver in the last series,
or
the Minister of the Interior in Borgen, or you know, which I quite like.
In a garage? Yeah.
But also traditionally, having watched a few of these kind of things, in the third or fourth episode, the crime that drama that you think you're watching gets solved, and all of a sudden it spins off into a new kind of angle that takes you, and it'll be interesting to see if that does the same thing here, or if actually it's just a straightforward 8 parts run, because you already know it's, you know, unless they're going to spend 5 parts chasing, looking for a caravan in the wilds of the kind of Scandinavian forest, you already know, you know, all the characters are there. And
what the thing I couldn't get past is 2 things. Firstly, the murderer looks like Steve Penk. Right, so that's very hard to, you know, imagine sort of bad episodes of, you know, You've Been Framed from years ago. But also the fact that in The Killing, you've got the fantastically compelling central character, and the same with, okay, Borgen isn't a murder show, but you've got, it's focused on a very, very compelling central character. And I think that's missing from this, because you've got Inga, the profiler, and, you know, we spend a lot of time with her, but it's not exactly a kind of massively compelling character for the ages, I don't think.
But it is. I think the key thing in the first episode, she makes a speech and she's talking about, and I've written it down, the incurable isolation of the soul. Mm-hmm. Her whole thing is being self-reserved, isn't it? Even more than your classic Swede, I think.
And the fact that, you know, with both her and the damaged, handsome police inspector, they've both got a backstory in that, you know, they've both been affected by their jobs.
They are a rock. They are an island.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was The Killing and that was The Bridge, and I sort of get the feeling that it's...
Isn't that quite interesting in a way, that they're slightly aware of the fact that everyone thinks that they're cold and they're self-examining themselves? Are we autistic?
Possibly so. Do you think we'd be watching these kind of police procedurals if they were in English and set in England? Are we actually watching them for the style rather than for the plot and the characters?
Well, we're watching them also for the interiors. That's why I'm watching.
Yeah,
I do like the kitchens. I think the kitchens are great. They've got very stylish, and it gives you ideas. Yeah. And we all go to IKEA, and you think that's how I'm going to apply my IKEA wear here.
IKEA should put staged murders in their shops. Wow. Blood up the walls, corpses everywhere.
That'd be brilliant.
Or they should partner up and do some sort of drama where they style all the, and then you can buy the kitchen where this brutal crime was committed.
Yeah, you could buy a kitchen called Forbridelsen or something like that.
I have to say, if you watch Lewis,
yes,
it's actually pretty much as good as most of these.
Yeah.
It's just
Happy Valley,
it's just
and those
more
kind
sentimental.
Of things,
Happy Valley's much better than most of them.
Yeah.
But and The Missing is, you know, one of these without subtitles. Yeah. One of the good ones. You know.
Although
the fact that BBC4 has started to chuck us all these Australian, slightly second-rate Australian versions. Yeah. I mean, we could be coming to the end of this, can't we?
It is ironic, isn't it, that we kind of we all fell in love with European and Scandinavian crime drama just as the whole country was falling out of love with Europe. It's kind of like it's TV for Remainers, isn't it? It's anti-Brexit
TV.
Yeah,
but look at the viewing figures.
I mean, yeah, I know. That's the impression.
They're less than 48%.
Yeah, very much so. Well, with a massively kind of grinding of gears, let's link that to Allied, which is set in Europe. The Second World War spy romance with Brad Pitt and Marianne Cotillard. This is a really quite a traditional and even an old-fashioned movie, isn't it? It's directed by Robert Zemeckis. Without wanting to give too much away, it's more about the state of the two spies' marriage than it is about the Second World War. James, what did you reckon?
I thought it was really bizarre.
Yeah,
It could have. At times, I honestly thought that it was a postmodern gag. Mm. It was like six different films. It changed. It seemed to shift every 20 minutes.
One minute
a
you think
film.
You're watching Casablanca, and then
thriller. Yeah. Then I thought it was going to go Quentin Tarantino. Then it came back and it was a romance, and then it turned into...
There was the Kelly's Heroes bit in the middle.
Yeah.
Where they do a kind of raid on a jail in occupied France, which is kind of, what?
And it wasn't until right at the end when I realised that it was a Night of Hold.
That's interesting though, isn't it? You know, the idea that a film can kind of break them all, because to me it was like, he has tried to make a war film that men and women can both go to. You know, it's not just a hail of bullets for blokes.
Well, I went to see it in an afternoon screening, and not just men and women, but the more mature end of the cinema-going audience. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's definitely they've kind of drawn it in. Yeah. They attempted to make a play for that. I just thought it didn't work. I thought Brad Pitt kind of has an ability to play the most wooden man on screen, and he might have been kind of trying to be a reserved spy, but you know, you just didn't get any spark at all. These people were supposed to be madly in love, so much so that he kind of risked his army career to bring her from occupied North Africa to England to marry her. And it was just like, you just felt like there was no spark there at all.
Difficult period though, wasn't it?
He was going through a difficult
period. Perhaps that affected him.
Well, maybe.
But isn't it the case that, I mean...
There was no sense of the turmoil that he was obviously suffering.
No,
he kept that very locked down.
I wrote a note during it in the scrawled cinema writing hand. It said, was Brad Pitt ever any good?
Well, I think the best things that he's in, when he's in those kind of Ocean's 11, he's playing a kind of really jaded bloke, and he's got a load of really interesting other actors around him doing stuff. If he's got to carry something like this, it's kind of mad.
But if this film had been presented in sepia, from 60 years ago, as the Lord intended, that kind of performance would fit perfectly well, wouldn't it?
Unfortunately,
I'm sorry, Dalek, I can't help you.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Was he going for that, you think?
Well, I classic think possibly
Hollywood.
So.
And the whole kind of like shoehorning in the fact that he's a Canadian Air Force man, just so that we can kind of, because he obviously can't do the British clipped vowels that would be kind of necessary.
And talking as someone who can pronounce Cotillard, I can safely say no Moroccan or French person would ever have believed he was French or Canadian.
Yeah.
Or French Canadian.
I just kind of thought that the whole thing was just a very, you know, given that Zemeckis his calling card is making films that rattle along at a great pace and that are really enjoyable to watch and with loads of kind of interesting kind of set pieces thrown in. I just thought this was kind of really dull and really disappointing.
And with all those, as you say, with all the effects in that, I don't think I've ever seen such a literal staging of an air raid in London.
Oh,
literally everything.
Yeah, that was the bit that made me laugh out loud, the giving birth in the middle of the Blitz. Yeah.
Someone had fun anyway.
Yeah. But you know, usually the Blitz is represented in film by people looking out of a window at something that you can't see on screen and going, isn't it awful what's happening over the East End? It's taking a pounding from Jerry tonight. Here, the special effects show it in forensic detail. It's all right up there in front of you, yet it's strangely unaffecting.
Yeah. I would like to point out that it's number two in the box office charts at the moment.
Yeah, so it's kind of,
it's kind of doing, it's the Fantastic Beasts and then this.
That's got to be first week.
First week.
Well,
yeah.
When I went, it was definitely an older viewer, and it was couples. You know, it was your mum and dad going to see a nice romance set in the war,
and the most embarrassing sex scene.
Well,
ever.
It's absolutely shocking, isn't it?
Well, it's just, you just kind of think...
For the benefit of the viewers, for the benefit of the viewers, there's a sex scene in a car in a sandstorm.
Titanic.
Brad Pitt's ass.
And I'm just, they're squeezed into this 1940s, whatever it is, French car, while a sandstorm is whipping in over the dunes, and they're getting it on. And I'm just thinking, mind the gear stick, Brad. You're not, mind the steering wheel, Brad. You're not going to, it's not physically
so I was just
possible.
Thinking that sand's going to play hell with that carburetor.
They've
got it faced completely the wrong way.
I was rather obsessed with the sand getting in the cars too. It's not a good sign.
Not a good sign for the drama. Okay, let's leave Allied behind, and we'll have another recommended tune. Ted Kessler, I believe you have Night Market by Burial. Tell us why.
Well, we all like Burial. Uh-huh. What we like about Burial is the fact that you recognise him straight away. You recognise that sound, even though there's no hook, there's no melody to his music really, beyond just the ambient sound of the city. He's got a really recognisable sound, and he did two albums in the mid noughties, and he stopped making albums and has sporadically just dropped these 12 inches, and this is the latest one that just appeared magically in a Canadian record store last week, where they accidentally, apparently, sold 5 copies, and now it's appeared on the internet. And it's just intriguing. I think it's great in the headphones and wandering around the town. I like Burial.
Very nice. Here we go. This is Night Market by Burial.
Come with me.
Night Market, the new single by Burial, or one side of the new single by Burial. Choice of our guest, Ted Kessler of Q Magazine. Okay, sticking with music, there are two key albums out this week, both by the modern voices of Heartbroken, Disillusion and Disaffection. Starboy is the third album by The Weeknd, a.k.a. Abel Tesfaye. Am I pronouncing that right? Kotiar Tesfaye. It's a collision of electronics, R&B and terrible, terrible self-doubt. And it was a Billboard number one on its very week of release. The other one is Hamburg Demonstrations by on-off libertine Peter Doherty, with an R. Made on the cheap in Hamburg, it's Doherty's second solo album and finds him somewhat rejuvenated after reconvening the libertines. Is it any good? Let's have a listen. This is I Don't Love Anyone, brackets, but you're not just anyone, close brackets.
I don't love anyone, you're not just anyone, you're not just
Peter Doherty with I Don't Love Anyone, But You're Not Just Anyone, from his new album Hamburg Demonstrations. Now, I've previously been immune to Pete Doherty's charms, but this album, I thought, isn't bad. James, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I agree. I have a real aversion to him because of the image, really. But every time I hear a solo album by him, I'm always surprised how much I quite like it.
Mm.
But it does go off, I think. There's bits where anytime it starts sounding like the Libertines, I am running screaming to hide in the corner. When it gets a bit buskery and he starts quoting old English revolutionary songs.
Yes.
No thanks.
But that is just, I mean, I've often thought that Doherty and the Libertines have a kind of weird relationship with the Clash, in that they've always liked the not very good,
I'd say,
Jones side of it, rather than the side that everybody else likes.
The Mick Jones side of it is really good.
Anyway, quoting when Johnny comes marching home from English Civil War,
yes,
is kind of like making it. He's not afraid of. But I mean, finding his influences.
The kids still like it, don't they? I mean, Jamie T is pretty much Pete Doherty with a little bit of
Pete Doherty you can take home and he won't steal your TV.
Yeah. Probably. But I don't think it's the kids. It's the 30-year-olds, isn't it? It's the ones who were the kids 10 years ago. And this is he's now an elder statesman for them. Ted, you're a bit closer to the Doherty world.
Well, let's get this straight. I think there's one good member in the Libertines, and that's Pete Doherty.
Right.
And Carl Barat wouldn't be in either. He wouldn't make it into the Clash, or the, and really, he's lucky to be in the Libertines. And
so when you're it's a Clash reserves.
I mean,
think,
he really
possibly.
Is. He's not a great songwriter. What about the cut the crap? He's a lovely lad.
What about the cut the crap era Clash?
Yeah, maybe actually. What one of the guys just
from the Cortinas? Yeah,
yeah. Head shape.
Vince.
Pete Doherty, he was the songwriter. He's the good songwriter in the band. And so when you extract him from that band and he makes a, and he's sort of concentrated, he can make a good record. And this is a very good Pete Doherty record. Mm. We've got a cover story with him next month written by Sylvia Patterson when mm-hmm. she went to the Bataclan in Paris with him for it was meant to be the reopening, but for some reason Sting snuck in there 3 days early and decided he was going to reopen it. Mm. And but I think his show belly flopped, and Doherty's show was apparently very moving and a big smash. And so I'm quite deep in his world at the moment.
Yeah,
and I know that he's given up heroin, and that may be something to do with why this record's slightly better and it feels a bit more focused. And
yeah.
He has done a few of these songs before. He has recorded them before, and they're sort of reboots of them. But I think this is probably his best.
One of them appears twice on this album, doesn't it?
That's true. Yeah. So I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the impression I got, and from somebody who's far away from the world of Pete Doherty, is that, you know, has he finally realised that if he shapes up, he can actually do some quite good work?
Well, he appears. We had to airbrush a crack pipe off the cover.
Oh, right. So he's not entirely...
So he's given up heroin, but...
He's given up heroin, but it's hard to give up the cocaine. I think that was the moral we drew from the story.
The heroin's always been the easy one.
Yeah. but I think he has cleaned up to a degree.
Yeah.
So to that degree.
I did quite smile at the press release that said that he basically turned up unannounced at this studio in Hamburg and said, "I want to move in for a month. Don't tell anybody I'm here." Your heart must kind of sink a little bit as a proprietor of a studio, thinking so, Pete Doherty's basically sleeping in the cupboards.
Give us a minute while I just run around and like nail everything down before Pete.
Yeah.
Pete
I don't think he turns up anywhere on his own either. I think there's always a few new friends he brings everywhere. Yeah. So
the songwriting, we're told repeatedly that, you know, he's the great songwriter in the tradition of Morrissey and Greasy and, you know, the Kinks and so forth. This is the first time I've actually been able to hear anything Kinksy going on. I thought the songwriting actually was quite good, and his I can't sing style of singing seems to work for once.
Yeah, I agree with that.
He's good. He's just not very prolific, is he? I mean, he's probably written 12 very good songs, 4 or 5 not so bad songs, and the rest aren't amazing. But so over the years it's totted up, but
yeah.
He's not a Ray Davis style.
There's one line that stuck out for me was, "Only love can heal the sickness of celebrity." Well, like, you sought this, mate. This is this didn't happen to you by accident. You created this mess that you're in.
Yeah, I think once you're in that mess, though, you do wonder, why am I in this mess? How did I get myself in here? Why did I choose this? Mm. I mean, but then you are stuck in it. I think maybe he might have been singing about Amy Winehouse as well, to a degree.
Is this going to speak to anybody who isn't already on the Libertines bus? Yeah, it's purely a fan base thing.
Yeah, well, you like it. You quite like it. You went on
I was surprised to like it when I listened to it, but I don't think I'd go running back to it and go, "Well, I've suddenly converted," you know.
No.
Because somebody like him with such a strong identity, shall we say, you either love him or you are actively repelled by him. And I think it's very hard to get that second group persuaded again, isn't it?
And also, the music is very, all the way through his career, and it's obviously a style that he kind of likes, but the music is, I'm always surprised by how spindly and weedy the music is, even when it's kind of rocking out.
It's
definitely
what he wants, though, isn't it?
Kind of, the tinny kind of, let's take the bass out and make everything kind of really toppy. Yeah, because it's kind of, there are bits that are a little bit kind of, not chanson, that gives it implies that it's something it's not, but, you know, his kind of sing-song talking style where he's obviously concentrating on the words, and I like that, and, you know, he does like, you know, he is kind of like somebody who likes putting words together, and I think that's a really, you know, it's a good thing.
Can sing, can't he? Because he did that. This one's for
steady on.
He can, though. Yeah, he just chooses not to. I mean, which is fine in this case, but often isn't. I think that track he did with, was he called Wolfman?
Yeah.
Anyone remember that? That's really good. Good song.
So it's better than he has been.
Yeah.
In some time. Let's talk about The Weeknd for a minute. Let's have four middle-aged white guys talking about the plight of Black America. This is a big, gleaming record. As I say, an instant US number one. And the subject matter is the emptiness and misery of his fabulous life. Ted, did you like The Weeknd album?
It just goes on for so long.
Yeah.
Mm. It's endless and it's so unfocused. I like the two Daft Punk tracks. I think they both should work together all the time because it helps both of them. And the Lana Del Rey is pretty good. Yeah. It's pretty good.
But
yeah.
That's a good piece of scheduling because halfway through the album, all of a sudden this voice goes, "Oh, that's really nice."
Yeah, that's nice. And we need that. But the actual album, I will not return to it. No.
It is surprising the degree to which the biggest stars in music right now are all about self-pity and all about kind of self-exclamation.
Oh, amazing sex, poor me.
Isn't it awful? Yeah, I'm going to kick three women out of bed and it's terrible.
I can't remember your name.
Yeah, I know. It's very...
I've just been given a teen awards. Yeah. I hate you all.
But this clearly is working, because we are not the audience, are we? But this is clearly working for the audience. People are seeing themselves in this somehow, are they? Aren't they?
Well, the current single is all over Capital, all over kind of ILR pop radio, and my daughter loves it, and she's 12 years old. Is she the, you know, and I'm hoping that all the jaded messages about life are kind of going over her head, but she's just, it's a bit of Daft Punk, fantastic kind of
great singles. So that's the thing, great singles, and that's how you get people to buy albums.
It's incredibly bland though, most of it.
Yeah.
I mean, coming from a different area, this isn't my area, this is the kind of area, like, same here, I've got a 14-year-old son who listens to music like this. It sounds like so many other things to me, and he's so enormous.
Yeah.
I would expect him to have some kind of USP. I can't see anything. I see more from Drake, you know, I get that.
Well, they're but sort
even
of
Coldplay. It sounds like Coldplay to me.
Well, Drake are sort of, okay, the music's not exactly the same, but they're mining a similar thing about the, you know, the misery of my life, and but also the kind of grand tragic drama of it, and I wonder
it's
if that's
egotistical,
solipsism.
even in popular music, it is so egotistical, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Once again, I was sadly disappointed that there wasn't the True Colours. Isn't in fact a cover of the Cyndi Lauper track,
that would have been great. And I love the Tears for Fears sample on this. It was like, hang on, I suppose that's absolutely off a piece with what it's about, isn't it? You know, kind of narcissism, solipsism, and, you know, a totally inward-looking thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, years ago, somebody in this position doing the big sort of R&B-influenced album of the moment, it would be outward-looking, it would be looking at the world, it would be... And also trying to get women into bed, because that's what, you know, sexy soul music is equally about that. But it would not be this kind of self-pity. And to me, it kind of connects with the whole kind of Vice, Pitchfork, Instagram thing of my life is a beautiful tragedy. Look at it. Isn't it amazing and awful at the same time? It works when he does the bangers, and it works when he's not talking about his misery. And this one is a banger, and it's not about misery. It's about dancing in a club. This is The Weeknd and Rockin'. There you go, house music, he can do it. That was The Weeknd and Rockin'. More of that from the album Starboy. Okay, so we're coming to the end of the show, and it's time, therefore, for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests pass on the story or the idea or the feature that's been obsessing them this week. James Med, Andy Murray, I believe.
Yeah, I'm big into sports. No, I'm not. I'm very... but I love Andy Murray. Firstly, because tennis is so intense, it's unbelievable. You watch them every single point, every second they have to focus. It's just them, there's no team. And then Andy Murray is the most down-to-earth superhero of the age and totally miserable. I love him.
You love his lack of charisma.
If he doesn't win Sports Personality of the Year, I will kick my television.
But to win Sports Personality of the Year, you need to have a personality,
don't
you?
He has a personality.
Is it an anti-personality?
I understand his personality precisely.
It is quite nice actually to be able to just pour yourself into somebody who's not making a big grandstanding Kanye West declaration about themselves and just doing it.
Yeah, he's great.
So I like him too. I like his like mardiness, the Mardy winner.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
It's so honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Wild Horses couldn't drag me to the tennis, but I do quite like the fact that he doesn't play the press game, and he doesn't play the sort of the image crafting game.
Yeah, no. Does he sell anything either? I mean, I haven't seen him on any adverts.
Well, he's got. I mean,
He must be sponsored.
But he's not out doing the he's not doing the orange squash stuff or
Head and Shoulders.
he's not doing Head and Shoulders. He's just concentrating on his
That went well for Joe Hart, didn't it?
Yeah.
What? Oh, yes, the dandruff. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I just think he's got dandruff now.
Yeah. Adam Lallana and Nivea as well.
Yeah.
Matt Hall, what's your closing time chatter?
It's also sporting. It's Lewis Hamilton, and I do not follow Grand Prix at all. I'm not interested in kind of car racing, Formula One. But Lewis Hamilton, I've just kind of got him pegged as the Kanye West of Formula One at the moment. he's having some form of kind of slightly interesting
freak out.
Yeah, he's kind of like, you know, started earlier in the season. He was Snapchatting pictures of other racing drivers with bunny ears on during a press conference, and of course all the journalists follow him on Snapchat so they could see what was going on while he was supposed to be kind of pushing the Mercedes party line, or is it Mercedes he writes? Yeah. But then this weekend he could only win the championship if his teammate lost the race, and so Hamilton started kind of basically driving really slowly and was being told through his headphones by the Mercedes in the pit that they needed him to speed up, and he needed to be doing X amount of, you know, a certain amount of minimum seconds per lap for them to win the championship. And he just kind of basically told them to go and screw themselves in the middle of a race, and was going, you know, there's a whole transcript now that's been released of this kind of conversation. And he's just like, well, guys, I'm about to lose the Formula One World Championship, so I don't really give a toss what you think. You know, you're just thinking like, this is a guy having a paddy while driving a very expensive, very fast car.
It'd be great if he went full Kanye and insisted on, you know, driving in, you know, ludicrously tricked out cars and wearing insane clothes.
It could well happen.
You know, parking his latest model girlfriend in the car while driving, driving it backwards, that kind of thing. What? Ted, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I feel like I should pick a sportsman.
You don't have to.
I feel like picking Ian Holloway as the new QPR manager, but I won't do that.
Captain Arsenal? Have you seen Captain Arsenal?
No.
Oh my God! Just hold that thought. That Captain Arsenal, the most tragic.
A middle-aged. Is it official?
I don't know. He's like he's a superhero to promote Arsenal FC. God bless him. He's about 60. He does not look like this. Is not Chris Hemsworth in the Thor outfit.
But he's in the full cape and mask, kind of posing around the Emirates Stadium, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's a bad idea.
Gooners assemble. Anyway, Ted, we interrupted.
Well, I guess my thing is just to try and remain positive for 2017. I know that's my Christmas message and end of year message, because I was watching the John Oliver end of year show the other day, and it was everyone saying "F you" to 2016.
Yes,
and it was, you know, and it's gloomy. We know 2016 has been generally a very bad year for lots of people.
Yeah.
But as I was watching, I was thinking, I've actually had quite a good year, and I felt guilty about having had a personally good year.
Mm.
And I thought that even though you feel that you're entering the end of times, really, it might not be. Maybe 2017 might not be that bad for each and every one of you.
I think you might be right for one simple reason, which is there's nobody left to die. Everybody has died.
You're a Bob Dylan fan. You're getting pretty
nice. Bob Dylan, Neil Young, there's all sorts of people.
That's the bit we're going to have to cut out before the broadcast.
Well, I'm going to leave you with my closing time chatter, which is I advise you to watch Planet Earth 2 with your cat. I've been watching David Attenborough's Planet Earth 2 as a social experiment with the cat, and it's been very interesting to see how the animal in my house has reacted to the animals on the screen, because whenever a jaguar or a panther or a leopard appears, she goes into fangirl mania. It's like watching, teenage girls when Take That One at their height. She's like up in front of the screen, kind of telegraphing this kind of, look at him, isn't he handsome? Look, he just bit the head off that crocodile. Isn't he cool? Isn't he cool? Isn't he cool? And then it cuts away. And also she seems very unfrightened by the fact that the mouse is actually six times the size of her, because it's a close-up. She still wants to kill it. But that idea that's hardwired into the cat's brain somewhere, it can still see in a two-dimensional image, that's the kind of gigantic feline that I want to hang out with. I only discovered recently that cats can now watch television because they're not on cathode ray tube anymore. Cathode ray tubes were on a different frequency and cats couldn't see anything. They just see a square in the corner. Why are the humans looking at that piece of glass? But now we've got plasma telly, cats can see what's on the screen.
Wow.
So it's a golden age of television for your cat.
Dogs can't, though, can they? My dog registers nothing.
Apparently.
You know what? Dogs. I mean, I love dogs, but. But they're just so stupid.
Well, at least they don't try and climb into the television screen and attack the footballers like the cat does. The other side of it is apparently ecological light bulbs kind of buzz on a frequency that we can't see, but cats can. Mm-hmm. So we think we've got this great sort of, you know, European mandated lovely light bulb that's saving the planet. But the cat feels like it's in Guantanamo Bay because the light's going bzz, 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 bzz. So there you go. Cat light bulb facts. That's where you come to Big Mouth, isn't it? So thanks very much for listening. That's the end of the show. Thanks to our guests, Ted Kessler of Q Magazine and James Med of The Times, The Guardian, The New Statesman and The Question. We'll be back
else.
And everything else. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can hear this show again and also all of our archive at audioboom.com. Just go there and search for Big Mouth. You can subscribe at iTunes. Just go to the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth. Please subscribe. Please leave a high star rating. We'd be delighted if you did that. And you can follow our podcasts and features and anything else you like at facebook.com/BigMouthUK. That's another one in the bag. Thanks very much, and we'll see you again soon.